Great. Thank you very much. Well, it's a real privilege to be asked to speak here. When Brian first gave me the invitation, I had a momentary panic thinking that he was asking me to fly to Belfast. Fortunately, through the marvels of modern technology, that's not necessary. Brian asked me if I would speak today on the Gospels and Acts as history. And I'm very glad to do that. If we move on to slide number two there, Brian, you'll see that this is something that it's very important to defend. In 2 Peter 1:16, we read, "For we did not follow cleverly devised myths when we made known to you the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but we were eyewitnesses of his majesty." Either that's true or it's not. If it is, we should be willing to take a bold stand and to defend the historicity of the accounts that we have of the power and majesty of our Lord Jesus Christ from eyewitnesses. Since this is a reasonable faith group, many of you are familiar with the minimal facts approach. And on slide three, I have just a little contrast set up here. A typical minimal facts approach, and this has been defended by Bill Craig and Gary Habermas with consummate skill, takes a few facts agreed upon by virtually all scholars and uses those to argue for the resurrection directly, bypassing the defense of the substantial historical truthfulness of the Gospels. I have great admiration for the people who have made that argument such a formidable weapon. But if the historicity of the Gospels can be maintained, then they afford much richer resources for argument than the minimal facts approach does. So tonight, I would like to argue that the forward ground can be held. We can maintain the substantial historicity of the historical books of the New Testament, the Gospels and Acts, and indeed the Pauline epistles, though I won't be speaking much about them here. On slide four, you'll see two trilemmas. You're all familiar, I take it, with the liar, lunatic, or lord trilemma made famous by C.S. Lewis, though it can be traced all the way back to Victorinus Afer and the Arian controversies. I'd like to suggest, though, that there's a different trilemma that we would do well to pay attention to, and it has to do not with the character of Christ himself, but the character of the writers of the Gospels and Acts. They were one of three things, I will argue, either deceivers or dupes or direct witnesses and those in contact with direct witnesses. Here's a more formal way to break it down. Either what the authors of the Gospels said was true or it was false. If it was true, we have the word of some direct witnesses. If it was false, either they knew that it was false, in which case they're deceivers, or they did not, in which case they're dupes. The material that we're going to go over tonight is designed to eliminate the last two horns of that trilemma, leaving the first horn as the only place left for us to go. So on slide five, assessing historical credibility, I'm going to talk at least briefly about five tests. I've arranged these under two headings. There are external tests and there are internal tests. Under external tests, we have attributions of authorship. This is a crucial test that we use constantly outside of New Testament studies to determine the authorship of a historical work. It could be the medical works of Hippocrates. How do we tell that it was written by the person to whom it's traditionally ascribed? We check the tradition. We see how far back it goes, how widespread it is, and so on. Second test, early use in other works. If they're used, they have to exist in order to be used. More than that, they have to be recognized as credible for the uses to which they're put. I'll go briefly over those two points. We can come back and talk more about those in the question and answer period if you like. Third external test, integration with other sources. This is where things become detailed. I'm going to spend quite a lot of time talking about how the New Testament books integrate with what we know of Palestinian and Greco-Roman history from other sources. We'll be using Josephus. We'll look at the evidence of some coins and other kinds of things like that. The internal tests, I've broken these down into two forms. The overall consistency among the books. Since we're talking about a collection of books, not just a single manuscript, but four authors writing five different works, we can cross-check between them. We can see whether they provide us with a generally consistent picture. I'm not going to get into the issue of inspiration tonight or inerrancy. I'm going to approach this as I would approach a secular historical document. So my question will not be, are they perfectly consistent? That's an interesting question for another time. But rather, are they sufficiently consistent that they have the same kind of profile that, say, Josephus Antiquities and his Jewish War have? There are some discrepancies between those two works, both by Josephus, dealing with the same topics. But he's considered to be a reliable historical source anyway. Finally, undesigned coincidences. This has become something of a signature argument of mine. We'll look at some of the ways in which the New Testament documents interlock with one another and ask what kind of evidence that provides for their historicity. So let's move on quickly to, before we move on, I guess I should say, I've tried to arrange these for easy memory, so if you're scanning down attributions, early use, integration, overall consistency, and undesigned coincidences, you will see the five vowels in order. I hope that that pleases someone. All right, on to slide number six. External evidence attribution. Back in the Contra Faustum, written around the year 400, Augustine had to deal with the very first attack, so far as we know, on the authorship of the Gospels. Before the year 400, we have no record that anyone ever questioned the apostolic authorship of Matthew and John and the historical traditional authorship of Mark and Luke. But in the year 400, more than three centuries after the last of these was written, Faustus decided he would take a crack at arguing that these were not written by the people to whom they had traditionally been ascribed. Here was Augustine's response. Why does no one doubt the authenticity of the books attributed to Hippocrates? Because, says Augustine, there is a succession of testimonies to the books from the time of Hippocrates to the present day, which makes it unreasonable, either now or hereafter, to have any doubt on the subject. How do we know the authorship of the works of Plato, Aristotle, Cicero, Varro, and other similar writers, but by the unbroken chain of evidence? Notice that Augustine is not special pleading here. He's arguing that there shall be no double standards. We shall not treat the New Testament books any differently than we would treat the works of Plato or Aristotle, Cicero, Varro, Hippocrates, or any other such author. So let's just briefly mention that unbroken chain. Here's a summary of the facts. I have more detail on this. If you want to go into the specifics, we can do that in the question and answer. The attestation of authorship for the Gospels is not only significant and early, it's also geographically diverse. It comes from every quarter of the Roman Empire. We have the word of Irenaeus in France, Papias in Asia Minor, Clement in Alexandria. So from all around the rim of the Mediterranean, we have witness to the authorship of our Gospels. These are second century authors, although Papias actually lived to become an adult in the first century and was a hearer of John himself. The second point that I think deserves to be stressed is that there is no rival tradition of authorship for any of the four Gospels. This is significant. There just isn't anything else there. You can find today people like Bart Ehrman who think that they're all anonymous in some strong sense, but you cannot find that in the first three centuries. You have to go up to the year 400 before you begin to have questions, and even then you don't have a tradition of authorship from anywhere else. Let's move on to slide eight. So here we see we've gone through just very, very quickly the first external test. We have strong and consistent attributions of authorship to authors in the first century, people who were in a position to know whereof they spoke. The next thing we need to move to is early use in other works. Here again, I apologize, I'm going to be brief. And I'm also going to violate every known rule of PowerPoint two slides from now, so hang on for it. But first, on to slide number nine. There are several works we could talk about here. I'll just talk about one, Polycarp's Epistle to the Philippians. This was written around the year 108. It's a patchwork of quotations, about 100 quotations from the New Testament. He quotes from nearly every book we've got. Matthew, Mark, Luke, Acts, Romans, 1st and 2nd Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians. There's probably a allusion to something in Colossians, but it's iffy, so I don't list it. 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, Hebrews, even 1st Peter. And there's more. I don't even have the whole list on here. So the point that I am trying to make is that just from Polycarp alone, you can get attestation that by 108, not only was a Christian minister familiar, intimately familiar with the New Testament, so familiar that he quotes it from memory over and over again, but also he expected that his audience at Philippi would recognize what he was saying as authoritative. That's very early attestation. Okay, on to slide number 10. Here we go. This chart, which I have quarried out of a larger chart, shows the use or direct citation of the four Gospels and Acts in a variety of early authorities. From left to right, the authorities are Ignatius, Polycarp, the heretic Marcion, the heretic Valentinus, Justin Martyr, Irenaeus, Clement of Alexandria, Tertullian, the Muratorian Canon, Origen, Eusebius, Codex Sinaiticus, Athanasius, Didymus the Blind, the Syriac Peshitta, and the Vulgate. I am not going to go point by point over this chart, but a blue check mark indicates that the work is used by or cited approvingly by the authority in question. An X means that it is noted but explicitly rejected by the authority in question. A checkmark with a slash through it we find only in Marcion's use of Luke. That means that he used Luke, but he cut some passages out that he didn't like. And a dot means that in the works of that authority, we cannot find any reference to the work. I'd like you to just take a moment to stare at that chart and look at the solid phalanx of attestation for the four canonical Gospels and the Book of Acts in all early authorities, and contrast that with the spotty attestation that we have in the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Truth, the Gospel of the Twelve, of Peter, of Basilides. The earliest that we have any attestation of them is the Gospel of Truth, because it's a Gnostic work, and who is it who cites it approvingly? Why, it's Valentinius. It's a Gnostic, so that's what we would expect. There's simply no comparison between the canonical Gospels and the Gnostic Gospels in terms of early use. So on to slide 11, I'm just going to put that one down as overwhelming. Early use in other works, the evidence is astonishing. No reasonable scholar who had no theological argument to push would for a moment doubt this kind of early use as attestation. Now we move on to the third point on slide 12, integration with other sources. Some people think that integration has to take the form of a direct pagan or Jewish attestation to the resurrection or some miraculous events in the life of Christ. This is not a reasonable standard to use. And the reason is very simple. 85% of the literature that we know was written in the second century has been lost. We have only titles in catalogs by other authors. Far more of the literature of the first century has been lost. Most everything of the Jews, except for Philo and Josephus, has been lost. And as far as the Romans were concerned, Christianity was a crackpot cult on the fringe of the far eastern edge of the empire. It was an offshoot of a despised religion. The Jews were the butts of the jokes of the Roman Empire. There was no reason for this to draw their attention unless and until it became important for some civic reason, such as finding a scapegoat for the Great Fire of Rome in the fall of the year 64 AD. We are looking for the writers of the New Testament documents to demonstrate familiarity with the Palestinian setting and the Greco-Roman world in general. You might think that that's a relatively easy thing. After all, if you wanted to write a first century novel, you'd fire up Google, you'd find a couple of points of data, and you'd start writing. But there was no Google in the first century. Some skeptics seem to have a dreadful time understanding this fundamental point. Philostratus' Life of Apollonius is sometimes brought up. It was used by Bart Ehrman in a fairly recent debate with Bill Craig, for example. It illustrates what happens when the author is not well-informed and a contemporary of the events he talks about. Philostratus lived in the second decade of the 200s, so he's a third-century author. He's writing about Apollonius, who is supposed to have lived basically through the first century, to have been born right around the time Jesus was born, and to have died around the time that the Apostle John died in the 90s of the first century. So Philostratus is separated by about a century and a quarter from the events that he's supposedly recording. What we find there is just a historical train wreck. Apollonius visits Nineveh and Babylon, and he discourses there with kings. The only problem is that at the time when Apollonius is supposed to have been there, both Nineveh and Babylon were abandoned ruins. In fact, Nineveh had been destroyed for over six centuries and was only being rebuilt just before Philostratus began to write his Life of Apollonius. These are simply illustrations of the wild anachronisms that we have. So the next time somebody brings up Philostratus, ask him whether he thinks being seven centuries off is maybe a little bit much to ask for in terms of historical accuracy. Let's move on to slide 13. These are the points that I'm going to talk about briefly under integration. I'm going to talk about the reference to Augustus in Acts 25, the denarius, a Roman coin, in Luke 20, Archelaus in Matthew 2. Briefly, the accuracy of Luke in giving titles of local and regional officials, Cyprus, Philippi, Thessalonica, Ephesus, and Malta, we'll touch on. And then I'm going to spend quite a bit of time on allegations of error. Because when we try to say that the New Testament is integrated into the Greco-Roman history of the time, we have to be prepared to address challenges that have been brought up by skeptics, saying this is not historically accurate, it does not fit together with what we know from outside the New Testament. So I'm going to take quite a few of those in order. Briefly then, to Augustus. In Luke chapter 2, we read that there's a decree sent out by Caesar Augustus just prior to Jesus' birth. When John the Baptist begins his ministry, Augustus is long dead. We're 15 years into the reign of his successor, Tiberius Caesar. So we're in the year AD 27. I'll come back to that later. That's an important date. 30 years after that, Paul makes an appeal from Festus to Augustus. Think about the timeline there for a moment. Augustus was Caesar before Jesus' birth. He died. His successor had been on the throne for about three decades, and then three decades further on, we find Paul appealing to Augustus. Now, no competent forger would make such a reference without explaining it. If you were writing long after the time that when these men lived, you would fill that out so that there would be no quirk of the eyebrows by your skeptical readers. Move to slide 15. Let's have a look. I love the evidence of coins. Numismatic evidence is insufficiently studied, in my opinion. Here we have a coin from the reign of Nero, and as you can see, reading around it from the bottom and going clockwise, it reads Nero, Caesar, Augustus. This was how he was styled. Nero, Claudius, Caesar, Augustus, Germanicus. So Luke passes a first test. Let's move on to the next one, the denarius. You remember the famous passage where the lawyers are attempting to trap Jesus and they ask him what sounds like a no-win question. Is it lawful to pay tribute to Caesar? If he says yes, he's siding with the Roman oppressors of the Jewish people. If he says no, they turn him over to the Roman authorities. Jesus' response is brilliant. But I never understood fully how brilliant until I stopped and saw a denarius. So Jesus says, show me a denarius. Whose likeness and inscription does it have? At this point, you can tell that they're staring at their sandal straps, and so all they say is, Caesar's. And Jesus says, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. Well, on slide 17, we've got a picture of that denarius. And you'll see in bold relief there the profile of Tiberius Caesar. Of course, that was the kind of thing that Second Temple Jews were constantly rioting about. Even the emblems of eagles on some shields were considered to be an offense to them and a violation of the second commandment. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything in heaven above, in the earth beneath, or the water under the earth. But Jesus doesn't mention only the image. He mentions the inscription. Let's decipher that. It's abbreviated. It says, Augustus Tiberius Caesar, son of the divine Augustus. This coin, by its inscription, celebrates the worship of the previous Roman emperor as a god. So it's not merely a violation of the second commandment. It's a violation of the first. You shall have no other gods before me. Jesus' pointed comments about the inscription are a mark of authenticity. A later writer, if he indeed had thought of that at all, would have felt the need to tell us what was around the edge of the coin. But a contemporary writer would know full well. It doesn't require any further explanation for Jesus' audience. Moving on to slide 19. Matthew 2 tells us the story of the slaughter of the innocents in Bethlehem and the flight into Egypt. This story is widely poo-pooed by historians because it is not substantiated by any other account of the slaughter of the innocents. I think that's a poor reason. That's an argument from silence, and I can talk more, if you like, in the question and answer time about the general infirmities of such arguments in ancient history. What I want to draw your attention to here, however, is a positive mark of authenticity. In Matthew 2:22, we read that when Joseph heard that Archelaus was reigning over Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there, and being warned in a dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee. So on slide 20, I've got a question. Since the whole point of this episode is that Herod the Great was dead, and Joseph, Mary, and the young Jesus are on their way back from Alexandria, east and then north, coming back up, and since Archelaus was his oldest son, they should have known that Archelaus would take the throne. That was very common for the Romans to allow the succession to pass through to the progeny of their client kings. So why does this come as news to Joseph? And why does the news cause him to change his plans and go into Galilee? Well, here's the news about Archelaus. Herod the Great had died, and a mob of angry Jews stoned some Roman soldiers just before the Passover of 4 BC. In panic, Archelaus sent a troop of armed horsemen to surround the temple, ordered them not to let anyone inside out, nobody outside in, and then he sent soldiers in and slaughtered 3,000 Jews in the temple. He canceled Passover. The hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions, Josephus says millions, of Jews who had converged for Passover were told to go home. So move to slide 23 and look at Joseph's decision again with that context. Making their way north from Egypt, they must have encountered distraught Jewish pilgrims carrying the news of the massacre. Of course, Joseph is not a fool. He thinks to himself, we fled Judea because there was a homicidal maniac on the throne killing Jews. We're headed back up there, and there's a new homicidal maniac on the throne killing Jews. And he decides to go up into Galilee, which, although Matthew does not say this here, was not part of what was willed to Archelaus. It went to his younger brother, Herod Antipas, who does feature later in the Gospels, and who had no such reputation. Briefly, let's talk about the accuracy of Acts. In his book, The Book of Acts in the Setting of Hellenistic History, Colin Hemer goes almost verse by verse through the last 16 chapters of Acts, listing 84 specific facts confirmed by historical and archaeological research. Ports, boundaries, landmarks, slang terminology, local languages, local deities, local industries, proper titles for numerous regional and local officials. I am not going to drag you through the entire list here, but on slide 25, I've compiled just 5 examples of the accuracy across a varied surface of Luke's allusions. The governor of Cyprus is called the Amphipetos, the proconsul. The magistrates of Philippi are strategoi, they're governors. Those of Thessalonica are simply politarchi, rulers, not strategoi. The chief executive magistrate in Ephesus is the grammateus, he's a town clerk. But when they get to the island of Malta, the person in charge there is merely a protos, the chief man. So in these 5 different, widely geographically separated settings, Luke nails the proper title, and we can confirm that from inscriptional evidence and other authors for every one of these 5 titles. We can talk more about Luke if you like. I never tire of talking about the accuracy of Luke, but we have other places to go. Let's move on. Slide 26, allegations of error. No inquiry into the integration of the Gospels and Acts with external sources would be complete until we say what can be said against them. So I've selected some instances from Christianity's critics, and I'm just going to go through these instances one by one. On slide 27, I've enumerated them. It's been claimed that the Gospels err in reference to kings and governors, that they err in reference to the high priests. It's been alleged that John invents a landmark to make a metaphorical point, that Nazareth didn't exist at the turn of the first century, that there were no synagogues in Capernaum in the first century, and that Luke bungles the date of the census under Quirinius. I hope that you recognize at least some of these. If you don't, hang on tight. Slide 28, those kings and governors. Let's look at how the governance of Judea is recorded throughout Matthew and Acts. In Matthew 2, Archelaus is reigning as a king in Judea. And of course, at the beginning of that chapter, Herod the Great was the king in Judea. In Matthew 27, we're some 36 years on, Pilate is a governor of Judea. But in Acts 12, a decade or so later, we find there's a Herod and he's king of Judea. And another decade and a half on, Felix is governor of Judea. Slide 29, this has prompted an accusation. So we have here a picture of Thomas Paine, sometimes thought of as an American patriot. If he ever was, he quickly lost that character when he advised the French how to conquer America using gunboats going down the coast of the American colonies. But let that be. Here's a quotation from Paine. There could be no such person, he says, as a King Herod, because the Jews and their country were under the dominion of Roman emperors who governed then by tetrarchs or governors. That's the extent of Thomas Paine's knowledge. On slide 30, we're going to enlist the help of our best source outside of the New Testament for life in Palestine in the first century. Indeed, the best systematic source altogether, Flavius Josephus, a Jewish historian. He was born around the year 37. He wrote several important works for our purposes. The 2 most important will be The Jewish War and The Antiquities of the Jews. In light of what Josephus has to say, let's have a look at what becomes of Paine's allegation. So slide 31. Matthew does not say that Archelaus was king. He says that he was reigning as king. He was kinging, basileuai. His claim to the throne, we learn from Josephus, had not yet been certified by Caesar. And indeed, one of the complaints against him was that he had taken the kingship over to himself without Caesar's permission. As it turns out, Caesar allowed him to continue to rule in Judea, but he never actually formally bestowed upon him the title of king. So Matthew and Josephus are in accord. Josephus and Luke also agree with regard to the situation in Acts chapter 12. There had been no time in the previous 3 decades, nor ever afterward, when there was a king of Jerusalem, except the last 3 years of the life of Herod Agrippa, as we find reading Josephus' Antiquities, books 18 and 19. In fact, Agrippa was given the full extent of the lands and holdings of Herod the Great, his grandfather. And that was a high point for the Jewish people, because Agrippa I was a man who favored the Jews. Indeed, in Luke 12:1, we find that he was willing to do the Jews a favor, and that's why he stretched out his hand to trouble the church. We don't have to take just Josephus' word for it there, so let's have a look at some more coins. Slide 33, Matthew 2:1 says, in the days of Herod the king, and although it's a little bit faded, you can see in this bronze 4-prutot coin, Herodou Basileos, King Herod, inscribed on it. In slide number 34, we can see that there is also inscriptional evidence on coins for Luke's usage in Acts 12. Each of these coins is fairly worn, but they say Agrippa Basileus, Agrippa the King. And they all date from the last few years of the reign of Agrippa the First. All right, let's move on to a new alleged contradiction. Luke 3, verses 1 and 2. Brian, I think you may need to click a second time to get this one to come up. In the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, during the high priesthood of Annas and Caiaphas, the word of God came to John, the son of Zechariah, in the wilderness, and so forth. Well, now, that's a little bit odd. Let's move on to slide 36 and get another bit of the puzzle here. John 18, verse 13, talking about the trial of Jesus. First, they led him to Annas, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. Now, in slide 37, we've got a charge laid against the New Testament authors by Robert Taylor, the original devil's chaplain. He was a minister turned skeptic and a devotee, believe it or not, of the astrological mythical approach that says that the books of the New Testament are all myths about astronomy. Jesus is the sun. The 12 apostles are the 12 signs of the zodiac and so forth. In his book, The Diegesis, Taylor says, any person being acquainted with the history and polity of the Jews must have known that there never was but one high priest at a time. And indeed, if we go back to the Old Testament, that's what we will find. Again, no Jew could have been ignorant that the high priest's office was not annual, but for life. And again, if we go back into the Old Testament, we find that that is the way that it's set up. So did Luke and John blunder. Slide 38. From Josephus, we discover that Annas had held the office of high priest and then had been deposed by Pilate's predecessor, who then successively appointed and deposed one after another, including one of Annas's sons. Joseph Caiaphas was his son-in-law. He was the fourth of those who had been put in place. Slide 39. Throughout the period of the gospel events and for more than a decade afterward, Annas kept the power of the high priesthood and controlled the temple through his sons. Ultimately, five of them were appointed high priest by Roman procurators. So Luke and John are vindicated after all. In fact, Josephus even uses the same language that is used by Luke in the Jewish War. Slide 40, he says, both Jonathan and Ananias, the high priests, again alluding to this strange double system where someone was high priest by official appointment of the Romans and another person was high priest by the right of the Jewish appointment, and the Jews referred to them both as high priests. Let's move on to 41 here and just see very briefly how this fact sheds light on Acts. Acts 23, Paul is being interrogated in front of the high priest. The high priest orders him to be slapped. Paul lashes out at him and is told, how do you dare to insult the high priest? And he says, I did not know, brothers, that he was the high priest. Again, Brian, I think you may need to click one more time on this. Ananias had been the high priest, but he had been deposed. And his successor, Jonathan, had then been murdered. In the meantime, He took it upon himself without Roman sanction to step back into the high priest's role. This fits the time at which Paul is in their hands. It's a debated point, but I think Paul is being sarcastic here. I think he knows that Ananias is not high priest, properly so called, and that when he says, I didn't know he was the high priest, the subtext is, because he's not. Let's move on and have a look at the allegation regarding John and the pool at Bethesda. In John 5:2, in a passing remark setting up the scene for a miracle, John remarks that the pool at Bethesda had five stoas, roofed colonnades or walkways or porches. Now there is in Jerusalem by the Sheep Gate a pool in Aramaic called Bethesda, which has five roofed colonnades. Slide 43, we see a picture here of Alfred Ferdinand Loisy, who was a turn of the 20th century biblical critic. Loisy was very fond of finding metaphors in scripture, and so here he tells us that those ancients who hoped to find in the source a Jewish symbol and in the five porches an allusion to the five books of the law undoubtedly encountered the thought of the evangelist. In other words, according to Loisy, all of this is merely a metaphor. The five porches are the five books of the law. The poor paralyzed man has been under the law for all of these years, and the law has done him no good, but Jesus came to supplant the law. Isn't that clever? Slide 44. Well, maybe not. Here's a picture of the pool at Bethesda, which has been thoroughly excavated. I talked to my colleague, the distinguished historian Paul Meyer, about it, and he said, yep, I've been there. 45. Archaeological work in 1956 revealed that it is located near the Sheep Gate, surrounded by four roofed colonnades and spanned across the middle by a fifth. No further comment is necessary. Let's move on to slide 46. Frank Zindler is a fairly well-known American atheist. I believe he was a chemistry professor and a bit of an amateur linguist, who decided that he would become an expert on the non-historicity of the New Testament. The quotation here is from one of his articles published in the American Atheist magazine for 1996-97. At the turn of the era, by which he means around the beginning of the first century AD, there was no place called Nazareth, and we do not know when the place now called by that name became so identified. Nazareth was as mythical as the Mary, Joseph, and Jesus family that was supposed to have lived there. There's someone I would like Mr. Frank Zindler to meet, and she's pictured on slide 47. This is Yardena Alexander of the Israeli Antiquities Authority, shown holding some bits of pottery discovered at a dig in Nazareth. Here from her article in 2009, the discovery is of the utmost importance since it reveals for the very first time a house from the Jewish village of Nazareth and thereby sheds light on the way of life at the time of Jesus. The building we found is small and modest, and it is most likely typical of the dwellings in Nazareth in that period. I discovered, after I went online to check what the atheists are saying about this, that some of them have actually heard about this dig, and they do have a response. Their response is, the Israeli Antiquities Authority is in a conspiracy with the Christian Church to pretend that Nazareth existed in order to boost tourism. I am not making this up. They are, but I'm not. Let's go on to slide 48. The gentleman pictured here is Robert M. Price, a scholar of sorts whose major claim to fame is that he is perhaps the last people to have held any kind of academic post who was willing to maintain the Christ myth position. He says, a major collision between the gospel tradition and archaeology concerns the existence of synagogues and Pharisees in pre-70 Galilee. Historical logic implies that there would not have been any since Pharisees fled to Galilee only after the fall of Jerusalem. Well, let's see what Frank Zindler has to say about that. He gets his licks in here, too. Capernaum, he says, like Nazareth, is unknown outside the Gospels before the end of the first century. Now, this matters, and on slide 50, we see why, because there's a quotation from Luke chapter 7 where a centurion has a sick servant. He wants to come to Jesus and ask Jesus to heal his servant, and the Jews plead his case, saying, he is worthy to have you do this for him, for he loves our nation, and he is the one who built us our synagogue. 51. Luke's language suggests that there's something impressive about the synagogue at Capernaum that would make it something requiring considerable funds to construct. Other passages, Mark chapter 1, Matthew chapter 4, make it plain that Capernaum was Jesus' home base. It was his base of operations in Galilee. So if there's a blunder on this score, that's a pretty big blunder. Well, archaeology to the rescue. Slide 52. From James Strange and Herschel Shanks, an article in Biblical Archaeology Review for 1983, the first century Capernaum synagogue in which Jesus preached has probably been found. It may not be the one he preached in. There might have been others, but this recently discovered first century building is a likely candidate. And then they present evidence culminating in the claim that the conclusion this was a first century AD synagogue seems inescapable. Let's see a picture of it in slide 53. This is a trench from the dig at Capernaum. In the upper right by the letter A, you can see white limestone blocks. Those are from a later synagogue, perhaps 4th century. But below that is a basalt wall from the 1st century synagogue. And that wall at a certain point does not actually line up perfectly with the wall of the later synagogue built on top of it. That's one of the ways we know it was an independent structure. Finally, we can see they've unearthed the cobbled pavement of the 1st century synagogue. You can see that at C. So on to slide 54. These walls are unusually thick. They're well over a meter thick, the basalt walls, and its floor plan shows it to have been a building with an interior space of nearly 450 square meters. This is about 50% larger than the largest other first century synagogue discovered in Galilee. So it was quite a magnificent structure, and this fits perfectly with the implication in Luke 7 that this synagogue was particularly magnificent. I'd love to linger, but we have to move on. Let's go to Luke 2, verses 1 and 2 on Quirinius and the census. I imagine that some of you have seen this used as a challenge to the historical accuracy of the New Testament. Here's a common translation. In those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed. This first taxation was made when Quirinius was governor of Syria. Now, taking that translation in the most natural way to read the English, and there is a problem with that, and all of the underlined words will come back under scrutiny as we move on, there is no record that Augustus ever taxed the entire Roman Empire, and Quirinius did not become governor of Syria until about 12 years after the birth of Jesus. So if Jesus was born in 4, Quirinius becomes governor when Archelaus is finally deposed for mismanagement around the year AD 8. Let's have a look at the Greek. I'm sorry for the small print on this slide, but I hope you can follow it. Here's a more accurate way of rendering the Greek. In those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all of the land, that's the word oikoumene, should be registered, apographisthai, registered or enrolled. This first registration was set in motion, agenita, when Quirinius was governor of Syria. Now, the three points that I want to make about this are, firstly, that Luke uses the word oikoumene to mean various regions. In Acts 11, he uses it to mean Judea. There's a famine, and it's throughout the whole oikoumene. The phrase is almost exactly the same as the one that he uses in Luke 2:1. But it clearly does not mean the whole Roman Empire. If you have the New International Version translation of this passage, you will find that they have helpfully supplied the word Roman where it does not belong. It is not found in the Greek. So they'll tell you the whole Roman world should be taxed. That's not what it says. So Luke uses oikoumene to mean more restricted regions. It could mean Judea or the domain of Herod the Great. Second, the word registration, apographe. This is not per se a taxing. This is an enrollment, a signing up. Because such a signing up was the first step in the actual levying of a tax, it is sometimes used by metonymy to mean the entire taxation, but it is also sometimes used to mean the initial registration. Third point, the verb agenita indicates that the registration was used as a basis for something that was set in motion or made when Quirinius became governor a dozen years later. Luke uses this verb in this very way to indicate something subsequently transpires. Again, in Acts chapter 11, verse 28, there's a prophecy of a famine, and he says, and this famine agenita during the reign of Claudius. If we read the passage this way, slide 57, there are several consequences. First of all, the fact that Luke directly mentions the census under Quirinius in Acts 5:37 doesn't have to be explained away. On the standard translation, you would have to ask, why does Luke make a mistake about something that he clearly knows full well happened because he mentions it in Acts 5? On this interpretation, that difficulty vanishes. Second, his brief reference to the registration corresponds to a reference in Josephus to an oath of allegiance to Caesar in Judea near the end of the reign of Herod the Great, which would be taken at the time of a registration. We have other documents from other registrations used as the basis for other taxings that show that an oath of allegiance was taken as a part of the registration. Finally, there's no need to predate the governorship of Quirinius to 6 BC. It is possible there is a time when he might have served as a special governing legate of Augustus himself there. That's one possible solution, but this solution, which has the backing of Greek scholars of renown, it's not my own invention, obviates that. We have no need to predate the governorship, and all apparent chronological discrepancies disappear. 58, the moral of the story. The New Testament authors get these details right, even though they are only incidental to their purpose. Unlike Josephus, none of these authors is writing a history of Palestine. But they are intimately familiar with that history because they lived through it and they knew those who did live through it. Well, where are we? We've got a few more minutes to go. Let's move on to 59. Actually, yeah, just a brief summary from a historian. It is evident that the entire historical framework in which the gospel picture is set is real, that the facts of the civil history, small and great, are true, and the personages correctly depicted. Slide 60. To suppose that there is this minute historical accuracy in all the accessories of the story and that the story itself is mythic is absurd. That was written by George Rawlinson in 1884. We have far more evidence now to support what Rawlinson has to say. So on 61, I sum it up that the integration with other sources is extensive and strong. By itself, this would be enough to establish the historical reliability and credibility of the sources that we're looking at. But let's move on and let's look at the internal tests. As I move to slide 62, everybody agrees that the Gospels tell broadly the same story. There are some differences in emphasis or selection. We find that every time we have a multiply attested historical event or period in ancient history. No two authors working independently ever select and emphasize the same data. If anyone would like to discuss that, I would say that Tacitus and Plutarch would form a nice pair to compare since they cover some of the same ground. Slide 53, before I go there, slide 62 still, different themes of organization are used in different documents of this type. These are Greek biographies, bioi, and in such documents, very broad chronological outlines, birth and early life first, death late, are used together with thematic organization that is out of chronological order sometimes in the middle. That's quite common, and we find that in the Gospels where thematically similar material is gathered together in the same place without being overly fastidious about chronology. We need to keep that in mind when we are talking about overall consistency because the events are sometimes told in different orders, and that would not have been considered a problem by a first century audience. The first century audience would understand that the order was never intended to be strictly chronological throughout. Okay, on to number 63. Here's an example of minute consistency among the documents. Luke 3:1, we have a famous verse. In the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, and he goes through and lists a bunch of other things, and then he says, the word of God came to John, the son of Zechariah, in the wilderness. Tiberius began to reign 2 years before the death of Augustus. He and Augustus were co-regents until Augustus' death in 14. Numismatic evidence indicates that his reign was dated from the earlier year. So the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar is probably around the year 27 AD. That would be the beginning of the ministry of John the Baptist, which, as we know, precedes the ministry of Jesus by a small margin. We're not sure exactly how much. But in slide 64, we have another chronological indicator. Jesus has cleansed the temple at the beginning of his ministry, as John tells in John 2, and he gets into a bit of a controversy with the Jews, who ask by what authority he does this. He tells them that if they destroy the temple, he'll raise it up in 3 days, and they say, it's taken 46 years to build this temple, and will you raise it up in 3 days? That incidental comment, which is not anywhere near the heart of the story, provides us a chronological hook to hang our reconstruction on. Herod the Great began constructing the temple around 18. Add 46 years to that, and you find that this confrontation takes place about the year 28 AD. So Jesus has just begun his public ministry, and here, near the beginning of it, but just after the date that we just calculated for the beginning of John the Baptist's ministry, Jesus is in the temple confronting the Jews. So much for some consistencies, and there are many other things of that sort that you can find yourself easily enough with a parallel column New Testament. Let's look at some alleged inconsistencies. On slide 65, I list three of these. I'll go through these quickly. I realize that we don't have unlimited amounts of time here. First, Luke has Jesus' ascension, so claimed, on the same day as the resurrection, unlike the other Gospels. Second, the four Gospels disagree as to which women went to the tomb on the morning of the resurrection. There is a video on YouTube of Bart Ehrman asking people which women went to the tomb. It depends on which Gospel you read. We'll have a look at that. Finally, there's the claim that according to Mark 16:8, the women told no one, which contradicts all the three of the other Gospels. On to slide 66 about the ascension. At the end of his Gospel, Luke does give a selective and telescoped narrative of events. He doesn't give us any clear chronological indicators. He certainly does not say that Jesus ascended on the day of the resurrection, and in Acts 1 he goes into great detail on the subject. So I just invite anyone who wants to talk about this to have a look at what Luke actually says, and you will see that he does not tell us how short or long the time period is. He telescopes all of the events together. He doesn't separate them out with clear chronological indicators, but it's an overreading to say that Luke places the ascension on the same day as the resurrection. So this one's just false. Slide 67. For the women at the tomb, each evangelist names one or more women who went to the tomb on Easter morning. All of them indicate that there were multiple women there. Even John, in John 20, has Mary Magdalene say, we know not where they have laid him. So even though she's the only one named, she indicates by her language that there were others with her. All of the Gospels indicate that there were multiple women there. None of them claims to give an exhaustive list, and Luke even says that there were others whom he does not name. So to say that there is a contradiction here is simply false. There would be a contradiction only if each author claimed to be giving an exhaustive list. How about Mark 16:8? Did the women never tell? It says that the women fled from the tomb and told no one, for they were afraid. And at that point, the best manuscripts of Mark do terminate abruptly. However, this is almost certainly not the end of the account as Mark wrote it. The original ending of Mark is lost, and the ending that you'll find in the authorized version is a later addition, probably itself still quite early, but not by Mark's hand. But there are important questions we have to ask. If the original ending is lost, then it's fully within our right to say that there was some kind of continuation. Looking through Mark's Gospel, we find that Mark regularly uses constructions where he says no one, and then an exception comes up. No one but, or no one except. So you can see in Mark 5, Mark 9, and Mark 10 there, I've got examples of that. We have every reason to believe that this was another one, and that The continuation was something like, "And told no one, for they were afraid, but running to the disciples," they, and so on, much as we have it, in fact, in one of the supplementary endings that people have invented for the ending of Mark, and in the other Gospels as well. Slide 69. I should say that as far as overall consistency among the books, that consistency is very good. But we have one more internal test. Let's move on to that. This is a bit of a fun one. Slide 70. Undesigned coincidences. Everyone knows that the Gospels run parallel to each other in various passages, sometimes nearly word for word. That's, of course, given rise to various hypotheses about how Mark may have been used as a source in the writing of Luke and of Matthew. But there are also places where they tell the same events rather differently, and still other places where they incidentally touch on the same points in different passages. Now, when two works by different authors interlock in a way that would be unlikely if one of them were copied from the other, or if both of them were copied from some third common source, when they fit together like that, then that is an evidence for a real historical event lying back of both accounts. This is a little bit difficult to describe, so let's just move straight into an example. Actually, I'll just mention on slide 71, fictions and forgeries aren't like this fictions because there is no independent reality grounding the multiple fictional accounts. Nobody reads The Lord of the Rings in order to explain a puzzling passage in Moby Dick. They don't share an independent reality. A forger doesn't want to leave dangling ends. He doesn't want to leave something for us to wonder about, for his readers to puzzle over, to wonder if maybe this isn't historical after all. But real events told by different people, artlessly, not worried that somebody's going to disbelieve them 20 centuries hence, do interlock like this. So 72. Here's a simple example from Matthew chapter 26. Jesus has been taken by night, and the guards are having some sport with him. Then they spit in his face and struck him, and some slapped him, saying, "Prophesy to us, you Christ. Who is it that struck you?" Well, a natural question arises, 73 here. What's the point of the taunt? Why couldn't Jesus see who had struck him? The lawyer Walter Chandler draws attention to the oddness of this point, and then takes us on to the passage on slide 74. Luke, telling the same scene in slightly different words, adds the detail, "They also blindfolded him." And then, of course, we have the explanation for what was puzzling in Matthew's account. Let's go to slide 75. A single undesigned coincidence like this is of very little use as an argument. One could be an accident. You could easily say, "Oh, Matthew just forgot to copy that bit from Luke," if he was copying from Luke at all. It's a little odd that the one detail he leaves out is the very one that's needed to explain what's puzzling about his account, but it is possible. But, slide 76, if we discover numerous undesigned coincidences crisscrossing the documents, then it becomes ridiculous to insist that they are all just accidental. So let's run quickly through a couple more. 77. In Matthew 8, we have the story of Jesus' healing of Peter's mother-in-law. She's healed, she rises, she begins to serve them, and that evening, people in the town bring to him many who were oppressed by demons, and he cast out the spirits with a word. So here's the question, slide 78. If the people believed Jesus could truly heal the sick, why did they wait until evening to come to him? Well, go to the parallel story in Mark chapter 1, slide 79, and you discover that on the Sabbath, he entered the synagogue and was teaching, and immediately he left the synagogue and entered the house of Simon and Andrew with James and John and healed Peter, that is Simon's mother-in-law. So it's a Sabbath day, and now we have no need to wonder about it. Slide 80. The people waited until sundown because they did not want to violate the well-known Jewish prohibition against work on the Sabbath. So Mark supplies the detail left out by Matthew. For those of you who are taking notes, slide 81 might be useful. If you want to make a little chart with Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John at the four corners of a square, you can begin to draw arrows showing which evangelist explains which. And this has some interesting features, so I'll keep that up a little bit as I go along. So far, we've got Luke explaining Matthew, and we have Mark explaining Matthew, but John's been left out of it. Don't worry, we'll pick him up. First, another intersynoptic connection, though. Notice in the Transfiguration, as Luke tells it in Luke chapter 9, Jesus' face is altered, his clothing becomes dazzlingly white. Moses and Elijah appear in glory. They speak of his departure. A cloud covers them. A voice comes out of it saying, "This is my son, my chosen one. Listen to him." And then, slide 83, they kept silent and told no one in those days anything of what they had seen. My reaction to this is on slide 84. They what? They kept silent. Why in the world would they keep silent about such a dramatic confirmation of the divine mission of their rabbi? Well, look at the parallel passage in Mark. Mark 9, verse 9. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus charged them to tell no one what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. So Mark gives us the explanation. Slide 86. Mark gives us the command, but he doesn't say whether they obeyed it. I encourage you to look at the Gospels and see how many times Jesus tells someone not to tell anyone about something and they go and do it anyway. There is no command more frequently disobeyed in all of the Gospels. Luke records their obedience, but he omits the command. Putting the two of them together, we can see what's going on. So on 87, we've got a little diagram growing, for those of you who are doing that. We're almost done here, Brian. I know I'm a little short on time, but I'm going to rush through it. Slide 88. Let's invent a gospel story. After all, this is what the authors of the New Testament are supposed to have done. Why should it be hard for us? So here's the challenge. You want to forge a miracle story about Jesus and pass it off as an authentic account. At the beginning, you're going to set it up by having Jesus ask one of his disciples a question. Slide 89. The setup for the miracle story is going to have to do with money and food. So here's the question. Which disciple do you pick? Now just take a moment here. Think about which disciple would first come to your mind. Maybe jot that down on your notes. When I do this with a live audience, people often pick Peter because he's very prominent. Some of them pick Judas because he had the purse, he had the money. So if it has to do with money and food, that would make sense. I occasionally get John because he's a major figure in the Gospels. Moving on to slide 90, though, we see what actually happened. Lifting up his eyes and seeing that a large crowd was coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat?" Jesus scarcely speaks another sentence to Philip throughout all of the Gospels. He's just not a major figure. Why Philip? Well, let's have a look. Go to slide 91. Luke gives us the setting for the same miracle, the feeding of the 5,000, and says that they withdrew apart to a town called Bethsaida, and then the crowds follow them there. That doesn't mention Philip, and indeed Luke nowhere mentions these words to Philip. But on slide number 2, we have another piece of the puzzle from John chapter 12, totally different section of John. Some Greeks come, they want to speak to Jesus, they come to Philip, and John just mentions in passing that Philip was from Bethsaida. So, slide 93, Luke and John fit together like the pieces of a puzzle. Luke doesn't mention Philip. John doesn't mention that Bethsaida was the location of the miracle. But by putting them together, we can understand why Jesus speaks to Philip in John chapter 6. Fiction is not like this. Different mythic accounts or legends created by different authors do not intersect each other in these ways. Slide 94, for those of you who are keeping chart of this, we've got Luke and John interacting very tightly now. On slide 95, John 21, notice this is after the resurrection. This is in the final chapter of John. They're sitting by the Sea of Galilee. Jesus asks Simon Peter, "Simon, do you love me more than these?" Why does Jesus ask that? Well, you can't find it out by going back to John chapter 13, but you can find it by going to Mark 14, the parallel passage, because Mark and Matthew as well explain that Peter made the boast that he was the most faithful of Jesus' disciples. So slide 96 shows that passage. One more here from Mark chapter 6, verses 31 and 39. Jesus tells the disciples to come away to a desolate place and rest a while. And then it adds, rather oddly, that many were coming and going and they had no leisure even to eat. Now, this is the only place where that's mentioned in the Gospels, that the crowds were giving them that kind of trouble. Then again, a few verses on, he commanded them all to sit down in groups on the green grass. Slide 98. About that green grass. This is a hillside located in the region of Galilee. The picture was taken in December, just before Christmas. There is not a lot of green grass in evidence. And indeed, if any of you have been to the Holy Land, you will recognize that at very few times of the year is there green grass. But slide 99 gives us the explanation of Mark coming from John. Now, the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. It turns out the Passover is smack in the middle of the approximately one-month-long growing season when there is lush green grass growing. John doesn't mention the greenness of the grass. Mark doesn't mention the Passover season. Slide 100, again, we see them integrated very tightly. I'll do one more, and then I'll wrap it up. Slide 101. Luke chapter 23 tells us the story of Jesus' trial before Pilate. He's brought before Pilate. The Jews accuse him and say that he says that he himself is Christ, a king. Pilate says, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus says, "You have said so." And Pilate says, "I find no guilt in this man." Slide 102, let's do the instant replay on that. This is completely baffling. The Jews make a grave accusation. This would be sedition. And a Roman governor should have great concern about that. Pilate questions Jesus on this very point. Jesus admits the charge, and Pilate promptly declares him innocent. This makes no sense as told. But go to John 18 for the parallel passage. The interview was longer than Luke records. In it, Pilate asked Jesus whether he was the king of the Jews, and Jesus explained that his kingdom is not of this world. Then Pilate went back outside and told the Jews that he finds no guilt in him. Slide 104. There are actually two undesigned coincidences here, because in John, the charge that Jesus made himself out to be a king is not reported. So Pilate's question comes out of the blue. Luke gives the accusation, but not the full answer. John gives the full answer, but not the accusation. We have to put them together to get the full picture. Neither of these authors copied from the other. Neither of these authors is simply elaborating a common underlying document. There is a real historical event lying behind these accounts. Brian, I don't know if you've got your microphone plugged in, but I have a, it turns out, just one or two more here. There is a connection that I can do, and then I'll wind it up and take questions. Would that work?
That sounds great.
Okay. Malchus's ear, slide 105. In John 18:10, we read that Peter cut off the right ear of the high priest's servant, and John tells us his name. In John 18:36, when Jesus is telling Pilate that his kingdom is not of this world, he continues, "If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting, that I might not be delivered over to the Jews." Something doesn't compute here. Doesn't cutting off someone's ear with a sword count as fighting? I mean, you know, I don't know what the playground rules were in the first century, but it seems to me that that would have counted as fighting. Well, this is all explained if we go to Luke 22, where we have the same scene. Luke tells the same story of the cutting off of the high priest's servant's ear. Jesus says no more of this, and he touched his ear and healed him. And now we can see why neither Peter nor Jesus is in any danger. Peter in no danger of arrest for this, and Jesus in no danger of being contradicted. There was no remaining physical evidence of the struggle. As with the scene on the shores of Galilee with Jesus and Peter, as with the feeding of the 5,000, this undesigned coincidence presupposes a miracle for its intelligibility. The setting of the miracle is presupposed. This is therefore not only evidence for the general historical reliability of the documents, but evidence for the miracles that they recount. 107, the numerous undesigned coincidences show that the Gospels were written by people who knew what really happened and reported it honestly. 108, the separate narratives are independently grounded in the same actual facts, and the details of the four Gospels interlock with one another and explain one another. So finally, on 109, we've assessed the historical credibility of the Gospels and Acts. We've applied external tests, looking at attributions of authorship, early use in other works, integration with other sources, and internal tests about overall consistency and undesigned coincidences. We've given our skeptics a chance to have their say and to provide examples of contradictions, and the evidence has come out extensive and convincing. I submit to you that this is an unsurpassable case for the historical credibility of the Gospels and Acts. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Dr. McGrew. We're going to open up the floor for questions. So one question is along the lines of borrowing works between the authors. I know you've shown how they sort of interlock, where one author is supporting another and vice versa, but why can't the skeptic come along and say that it was simply them borrowing material?
Well, the problem with trying to do that as far as undesigned coincidences are concerned is that generally the material's not there to be borrowed. So take the undesigned coincidences between Luke 23 and John 18. Did Luke borrow from John the accusation that Jesus was claiming to be a king? No, he can't. It's not there in John. Did John borrow from Luke the point that Jesus' kingdom was not of this world? No, he can't. Luke doesn't report that. So again and again we find that the feeding of the 5,000, the turning to Philip, Philip is not mentioned in Luke. Bethsaida is not mentioned as the setting in John. These cannot be borrowing from one another. Now, there are places where the same story is told in nearly the same words in the Synoptic Gospels. So frequently, you'll have a passage in Luke that parallels Mark almost word for word. I have no problem saying that Luke may have borrowed that from Mark. In fact, that would make good sense. Luke says right at the outset of his gospel that he uses sources that others had undertaken to write an account of this. So that makes very good sense. But the undesigned coincidences are cases where literally the material isn't there to be borrowed. It can't be borrowed. That's part of the special force of the undesigned coincidences. They cannot be explained away in that fashion.
Hello. What you've been saying is extremely interesting, a lot of which I hadn't heard before, and it would take a lot of study to grasp a lot of the evidence that you've been giving. In my life, I would come across people who may say at a very basic level that they don't believe in the Gospels, that they're stories and so on. Could you possibly reduce what you've been saying to a layman's response that I might give to someone who asks and could not cope with all the information that you've been given, and
sure,
indeed I couldn't give it, to how a person like that could be responded to? Thank you.
Right. I think what I would say is that all the time we distinguish between history and fiction. Sometimes we read things in the newspaper or see them on the telly and we say, that is being presented to me as fact, but it's fiction. That's a distinction that everyone has to make. There's no exception from this. You can be a pensioner who never made it out of the sixth forms, and you can still distinguish between fact and fiction. So when someone says, oh, I just don't believe the Gospels, they're just a bunch of stories, I would say, how do you tell the difference between stories that were never meant to be history and real history. How do you tell the difference between, pick a favorite fairy tale of yours, and the accounts of Julius Caesar? Or even someone who lived more recently. How do you tell the difference? And the answer is, we tell the difference by checking to see what the evidence is at the time. We look to see how well it's tied into the time. In fact, my entire study of this issue was prompted some years ago when someone said to me, it's really surprising how little connection the New Testament has to the rest of history. And I said, what? You're kidding me. And so I began to do my own investigation, and although I knew of some of the ways in which it's integrated with the rest of history, I had no idea how extensive that evidence was. So instead of trying to take somebody like this through the archaeology and the coins and the different Herods, I'd just do it with a question. I would say, well, how do you tell something's really historically true and it's just fiction? Most people will come out with some sensible tests. They'll come, well, you know, there was no record of it at the time. Well, there are these obvious mistakes that are made in chronology, like in Philostratus' Life of Apollonius. They may not have that example at their fingertips, but they'll say something to that effect. Well, fiction doesn't link up with reality. And you can take it from there. I will make the slides of this PowerPoint presentation available. Brian, feel free to give my email address to anyone who would like it. I'd be happy to correspond with you, give you more sources. But I would just start there. I would say, well, how do you tell the difference between fiction and fact? And then show that by any reasonable standard, the New Testament documents meet and exceed the standards that we would hold any other ancient document of comparable antiquity to. So that's the best advice that I can offer without actually knowing whom you might have in mind.
Hi. You mentioned during your talk lack of evidence and how you say something, there's no evidence outside of the Gospels.
Right.
And evidence that it didn't happen. One of the famous examples would be the massacre when Jesus was born. And the babies were killed. Another, what would you say to someone who said, say, you know, in Matthew 27, where it talks about there being 3 hours of darkness and lots of dead bodies being raised, that there is no evidence outside the Gospels, and that in an event like that, you'd think there would be more evidence in maybe Roman or Jewish sources? How would you respond to that?
Right, and another similar one to that has to do with the fact that the resurrection of Lazarus is not mentioned in the Synoptic Gospels. So the charge goes right here in your own Christian documents. You've got a stupendous miracle. And in the three earliest of the Gospels, there's no mention of it. Doesn't that betoken some kind of later legendary development rather than sober history being written by eyewitnesses and so forth? The framework for the answer to that is that if you study the argument from silence, the argumentum ex silentio, across ancient history, it's just terrible. It has a terrible track. Josephus records that Herod the Great had the chief men from every family in Judea locked up in a building called the Hippodrome and gave orders that at the hour of his death, before the news of his death spread out, they were all to be killed. That way, in his twisted mind, there would be a great mourning upon the time of his death. Herod duly dies, and the people who are left in charge do not carry out his instruction, but they let the Jews go home. However, they had all been locked up in there first. Josephus is the only one who reports this. We don't see it in Philo. We don't see it in any Roman source. Should we doubt it because there's only a single attestation and it's a very strange kind of thing to do? Well, no. No historian of Josephus doubts this. Multiple attestation comes about only through the confluence of several different factors. Most of the documentary remains of ancient history are lost. And they're not preserved in accordance with our wishes or the corroboration of our preferred theories. they're just destroyed by the ravages of time and war and burned for fuel and other kinds of things like that. So it's really a chancy business. What's going to survive? Maybe I can make this a little more striking if I point out that there's no record of Thucydides and his history for several hundred years after he wrote. So our first mention of him comes hundreds of years later. In the archives at Barcelona, there's no record of Christopher Columbus having sailed into port with the ragtag remnants of his little fleet that had circumnavigated the globe. The eruption of Mount Vesuvius in the year 79 AD destroyed two very heavily populated towns, Herculaneum and Pompeii, and we have a meticulous account of the eruption from Pliny, and he mentions all kinds of interesting things about the eruption, but he doesn't mention the destruction of those towns. So it's very difficult to say what will survive, and it's very difficult to divine all of the motives that someone may have for not mentioning something. Maybe he mentioned it in something else that he wrote, and we don't have that. And he didn't want to repeat it. In the case of someone like Lazarus, a plausible conjecture put forward by Hugo Grotius, the great 17th century lawyer and apologist, is that Lazarus' name is not mentioned in the Synoptic Gospels for reasons of protective anonymity. After all, in John's own account, once Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead, the Jews take counsel how they might kill him and make him stay dead this time, presumably, because they say that otherwise the news of this notable miracle may get out and Jesus may have even more followers. So there are all sorts of reasons. It's very difficult to discern what they might be. As far as the passage in Matthew 27 is concerned, there are aspects of that that are paralleled in the other Gospels, but not the saints coming out of the tombs. That's the bit that's unique to Matthew. And as for that, is Matthew reporting firsthand information here? We can't tell. He may have heard it from some other people and not had any more details to give us. If there were saints who were resurrected, they may not have wanted their names and whereabouts spread around. It's just very difficult to say what was going on there. It is an odd passage. I concede that. As for the slaughter of the innocents, Bethlehem was a small town, population probably well under 1,000. Children who had not yet reached their second year, as the Jews would count that, children who were, as we would say, 1 year old, or less than 1 year old, there probably were a dozen or fewer. It was not a large-scale event. It did not, in the eyes of someone like Josephus, have any civic significance, so why should he report it? He's too busy reporting Herod the Great's killing of his own sons, his murdering of his own wife. He's too busy telling about these things that have dramatic civic implications. A few Jewish kids in a backwater town wouldn't reflect well on Herod the Great, whose biography is generally portrayed about as positively as it was possible to portray an insane murderer. By Josephus, there was no need to add this extra detail that really didn't have any civic importance. So I think that's the way it is for a lot of things. There are just numerous examples of the failure of the argument from silence in ancient history. If we relied on that, we would be throwing out most of what we know about ancient history.
Just a quick follow-up question, sort of along that lines. Sometimes you hear the phrase, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. As if, for instance, there are many miracle claims within the Gospels. Those are extraordinary events. Should the evidence we have for them be equally profound?
Well, it depends on what you mean by the question. If you mean, do I need a miracle now to believe a report of a miracle then I think it's an unreasonable standard. If you mean merely, let's not be dupes, let's have good evidence before we accept a claim for something so far out of the ordinary run of things, then I accept the standard, but I think it can be met and more than met by the New Testament evidence. Any reasonable interpretation of that standard is one that should give us no pause. We should just say, that's great. I'm glad you're willing to talk about evidence. Let's talk about the evidence. Let's talk about the historical evidence here. And force them into that trilemma that I outlined at the very beginning of the talk, that they were deceivers, they were dupes, or they gave us direct witness. Because, really, once we lay it out well enough, it's clear that these people knew whereof they spoke. William Paley, the great apologist of the late 18th century, said in his view of the evidences of Christianity that there's satisfactory evidence that many professing to be original witnesses of the Christian miracles passed their lives in labors, dangers, and sufferings voluntarily undertaken in account of the in attestation of the accounts that they delivered, and solely on account of their belief of those accounts, and that from the same motives they submitted to new rules of conduct. People don't do that for things they know are false. You need an adequate explanation for the facts that we can historically nail down. No, you cannot historically put the power of God in a test tube or apply a voltmeter to it. But you can note certain facts that require an explanation, and you can note that no non-supernatural explanations are adequate to the facts. And I'm perfectly happy if someone wants to take a conversation then in the direction of saying, well, what about miracles in other religions? What about Joseph Smith and the golden plates and the angel Moroni? Let's talk evidence. When they get onto the evidential ground, they are on our ground. That's great. So I would just take the very bold, forthright position on that and say I would be delighted to compare the evidence for Christianity to the evidence of any other kind of event.
Hello, Tim. David Glass here.
Hey, David. Good to hear from you.
Great to see you. And thank you very much for a very interesting talk indeed. Please pass on my regards to Lydia as well.
I will.
Yeah. That was fascinating material. So thank you very much indeed for that. I've a question or two just about the following on from Brian's about methodology here. You mentioned the minimal facts approach at the start. You also mentioned inerrancy, that you weren't defending inerrancy. Now, somewhere in between those two, I guess, is what you're aiming for. In terms of inerrancy, although you're not defending it, a lot of what you're saying is would certainly be of a lot of assistance to someone trying to do that, and you're getting pretty close to it, I guess.
Right.
But on the minimal facts approach and how your work might help to make a more robust case for something like the resurrection, could you just comment on that a little bit further as to how that could help to flesh out
Sure.
a minimal facts approach and make it much stronger, perhaps?
Sure. Let me just say two things. First of all, the reason that I don't get into the inerrancy issue is that I am trying to approach this very much as a historian, not as a theologian. And that's actually a strength of the approach, because it means that you can't be accused of special pleading. You know, well, every theologian wants to defend his own theology, so of course you're going to say these documents are inerrant or something like that. And so I'm trying to take the approach here that can be defended on strictly historical grounds, and therefore to take the moral high ground in a discussion where someone wants to hold the New Testament to some standard that's unreasonable and to say, no double standards. We're going to use the same standard as we would use for the investigation of any remarkable claim in any other document. So if you want to bring up the prodigies of Herodotus, I say, bring it on. Let's talk about what kind of knowledge Herodotus shows of those events and whether he was in a position to know and things like that. As far as how it might be used to strengthen the minimal facts approach, let me just give you one example of this, and there are many, but this will just be a quick one. One of the favorite skeptical hypotheses regarding the reports that we have of the resurrection is the hallucination hypothesis. The disciples, yes, maybe according to that minimal fact, they had some experiences which they believed were experiences of the risen Jesus, but perhaps those were just hallucinations. Now, it seems to me obvious that our best data for responding to the allegation that it was a hallucination will come from the detailed records in the Gospels. We'll go to the Gospel of Luke and we'll say, look, we've got a record of Jesus coming in and being seen by multiple people, once asking to be handed a piece of fish to show them that he's flesh and blood and not a ghost. there are these complex, multi-person, polymodal experiences. And if there's one thing we know from the psychological research regarding hallucination, it's that that is not what you get. You don't get these extended across 40 days. And you don't have them then suddenly ceasing. There are experiences where people fall into ecstasies of various kinds and other members of the group suddenly get ecstatic kinds of experiences, but those tend to snowball rather than to stop suddenly. If we can trust the Gospels as historical records, if we have shown that in the various places where we can put them to the test, they stand up brilliantly, then anyone who wants to say they're fictions is forced into what I might call the fraud of the gaps. Forced into a position of saying, well, yes, yes, they're historically accurate everywhere that we can check them. But in exactly those places where we don't have any other independent way in, well, those are the places where they're completely fictional. And that, I submit, is unreasonable. And that can be called out as unreasonable by the standards of ordinary history. So in responding to something like the hallucination hypothesis, if all that you have is the minimal fact agreed upon by many scholars that the disciples had some sort of experience, then you're not in as strong a position to argue against hallucination as you are if you can say, no, let me tell you what kind of experience it was. Let me give you details from multiple authors, details from accounts that can be in other ways coordinated with each other to show that they are actual historical accounts. Those details provide the fulcrum for making the argument stronger. Does that help, David?
Yes, very much indeed. Thank you. That was very clear. Can I just follow it up a little bit? Because you've talked about how that could help in a particular case, and I think that's very helpful indeed in the hallucinations. But from what you've been saying, and the case seems so clear on many of these points, I take it that you're probably suggesting not merely to help the minimal facts approach, but to take an approach which is much stronger, much more robust, taking on board a much wider range of evidence and so forth in terms of making a case for the resurrection. I take it that's how you would see it going?
I find that persuasive myself. That's the approach that I find satisfies my intellectual curiosity and my own inner skeptic. So, yes, I do want to take on that range of evidence, but as the woman pointed out who raised the question earlier, not everyone has made a careful study of this. Not everyone is in a position to cite all of these pieces of evidence, to rattle off the various Greek words that Luke uses for different kinds of local and regional officials. And so, I guess I want to say, let both approaches flourish. If you want to make a minimal facts approach, it's eminently suited to small-scale discussions and timed debates, because those facts are agreed upon by virtually all scholars. Since they're agreed upon by the scholars, anyone who wishes to challenge you has the burden of setting himself up as a sort of expert in his own right. And so that can be very valuable in certain kinds of situations. But if you're corresponding with someone, and I have an extensive correspondence with Christians and skeptics from around the world, you want to be able to go into the matter more deeply if you can. And what I have become persuaded is that one can go into the matter very deeply and come away thoroughly satisfied. And if we can do that, it might not always be the right approach in all conversations. There might be cases where, as we would say, to dump the truck is the wrong approach and would only baffle or annoy someone. But in cases where the conversation naturally moves deeper, then I would say you should be prepared to move deeper. And that is where this material can be of greatest value.
I know it sort of more touches on the topic of inerrancy, but one of the common things I would get from sort of skeptics would be sort of, how do you reconcile the difference between Matthew and Luke's bloodline of Jesus? Like, they're
right.
Very different. It's quite right. Different. I've heard a couple of explanations, but what would be your take on that? Thanks.
My opinion on the subject is that the genealogy given in Luke is intended to be the genealogy of Mary. If you look at the Greek, you'll find that there's actually a dispute as far as which text family you use, but that in the older text families, which are the basis for most modern translations, it says that Jesus was the son, as it was supposed, of Joseph. That seems to be bracketing Joseph out of the line. I don't see how we can take that way of phrasing it and not agree that whatever else the genealogy in Luke is, it's not the genealogy of Joseph himself. Now, there is a genealogy in Nehemiah 7, I believe it may be 753, where the bloodline of the progeny of a certain union goes through the wife to the father. And even though, strictly speaking, the husband is not that man's son, it's reckoned up through his wife, who is not named, just as Mary is not named in Luke's genealogy. So this is Nehemiah 7, it's either 53 or 63, you can check it up. That's an exact parallel from an unimpeachable Jewish source of reckoning a bloodline through a woman rather than through her husband, but naming the husband in the course of doing it. So that seems to me to be a good parallel. There are other conjectures that have been put forward regarding the two genealogies, but that's the one that I find most persuasive, and it's best seen in the Greek. One of the reasons it's best seen in the Greek is that English translations tend to be overly helpful, and they will supply things like who was the son of, where the word son doesn't appear. And that's the case in Luke. The whole chain all the way through, who was the son of so-and-so, who was the son of such-and-such, the word son does not appear. It's just who was of, not who was the son of. One other interesting detail, there is a Jewish source that speaks of Mary very unflatteringly, and that mentions that she was the daughter of Heli, which is the name next mentioned in the genealogy, and so that would also fit together with the notion that this is Mary's genealogy. The interpretation of that source is a little bit difficult and is somewhat disputed. I think it probably was a reference to her father and is thus a corroboration of this interpretation, but it's hard to place a whole lot of weight on that particular point. But that's the direction that I would go with it. So that is a common question, you're right.
You touched on it there about Mark 16 and about the last few verses of it. And really my question is, could you give a synopsis or request is, could you give a synopsis of how well we can take the authority of that in your view from a historical point of view, maybe even as breaching into the authorship and the divine authorship of it?
Right. Here's what I would say first. God has seen fit to give us his word by human authors. And one of the beautiful things about that is that when you get honest human reporters reporting what they know or what they have reliably been told, sometimes those fit together in very unexpected ways. That's the whole point of the argument from undesigned coincidences. If we had only one account, say a harmony of all four Gospels written together in a single continuous narrative like the Diatessaron of Tatian in the second century, we would lose the ability to compare the documents one with another. And sometimes it's the very omissions that help us most. In the case of Mark, there's a textual dispute. The devotees of the majority text, the text supported by most of the manuscripts, the Byzantine text families, maintain that the long ending is authentic. on purely textual grounds, the case is debatable in my judgment. The weight of the evidence lies on the side of the less numerous but older manuscripts from the Alexandrian text family. What that means is that either Mark got interrupted in the writing of his gospel, or somehow the last leaf of it got torn off before copies that have come into our possession were transcribed. Christians were among the first to use codices, that is, books, rather than scrolls. And the final page of a book is especially vulnerable to being ripped off, soiled, burned, you know, whatever else, damaged in various ways. So it is possible that it just did get lost, and that seems to be the best explanation we've got. I don't think that we need to be overly concerned about the fact that people came along and said, this looks incomplete, and tried to fill it in. We have four endings for the Gospel of Mark after 16 verse 8. And some of them seem obviously just to be patched together from the other Gospels, which was as reasonable a way of filling out the story as anyone could wish. I don't think that there was any harm intended there. I don't think anybody thought he was tampering with the mains, as it were, that he was sort of rewiring the Gospels while the electricity was on. They were simply trying to fill out something that had obviously been cut off in mid-sentence, really, because the way that it ends with Ephabonto gar is very unnatural as an ending for a sentence in Greek. The ending that we have in the authorized version, the long ending that takes us through to verse 20, was perhaps written by one of the 70. There is a later suggestion that it might have been a member of the 70 disciples, not the inner circle, but the next ring out, named Ariston. That is possible. I don't think that we can decisively confirm or decisively deny that, but it's an interesting possibility. But if that's the case, it was written in response to the felt incompleteness of the document. But here we are, with such documents as we have, in whatever state of completeness they happen to be, and we do not lack good evidence. And that, I think, has to be really the key point. If we were left truly without good evidence, truly in a position where we had to say, well, we're told to believe these things, but it's very difficult to tell whether they're true, then this kind of robust empirical argument that I am advocating would not be as powerful. But we're not. God has not left himself without historical witness. And the documents, in the very condition in which we have them, Mark probably incomplete, and Luke giving us only sometimes a compressed account of events that he was not a personal witness to, nevertheless provide us superb evidence, evidence of the kind that can be explicated by the very historical standards we use everywhere else for the veracity of these writers. I think that's all that we have a right to ask for, and that I don't, it really doesn't, in my mind, cast any doubts on the doctrine of inspiration. God was not caught by surprise. He knew what we would have.
Well, finally, Tim, we want to thank you for joining us for Reasonable Faith Belfast. It's been great having you here. I wondered if just in closing, what would you want to encourage just those who are listening and watching today as far as their own studies of the Gospels and the New Testament? How would you want to encourage them just to go dig deeper and to kind of explore them in their more richness and their fullness?
Read. Read new works. Read old works. Read new commentaries that you disagree with. Read old commentaries that you disagree with. Read everything you can get your hands on. There are some wonderful older works that put together this more robust apologetic in a way that some of the newer works have shied away from. I would recommend particularly William Paley's work, A View of the Evidences of Christianity. I think that work stands up extremely well to modern study. There are some places where it needs to be updated, but on the whole, it's a marvelous repository of information. Paley pioneered the argument for undesigned coincidences. There are wonderful resources for confirmation of the resurrection in the Pauline epistles. There are connections between Acts and the Pauline epistles. The first exploitation of undesigned coincidences was to look at coordinating the book of Acts with Paul's epistles, and Paley himself wrote a whole book called The Horae Paulinae on that subject. I would be delighted if anyone would like to write to me and ask for particular suggestions on particular topics. I love to suggest books. I'm a professor. I chase graduate students down the hallway as they're fleeing, saying, "Wait, I thought of three more." So you'd be very welcome to come and ask me for sources. I can make a bibliography on the subject available to Brian. Brian, you'd be very welcome to pass that around to anyone. But yeah, read good modern authors like Craig Evans, and read good older authors. Read Augustine, read some of the fathers. Bart Ehrman in Jesus, Apocalyptic Prophet of the New Millennium, on page 42, uses an argument that Augustine refuted in the year 400 about Matthew 9:9. That's shameful. The only thing more shameful than that is if we fail to read these works from eras bygone and don't realize that there were fine answers given to these arguments. So read widely, read the old stuff. There's much powerful information in the older works of apologetics. You can find some of that at my website, historicalapologetics.org. But certainly write to me if you want more.
Well, Dr. McGrew, thank you so much from everyone here at Reasonable Faith Belfast. It's been extremely fascinating. It's been encouraging. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a delight.